As we've been looking through the account of Jacob, we've been seeing different names for God. And last time we saw that God came to Jacob as the God of Bethel. And Jacob and Leah and Rachel had to trust God, the God of Bethel, the one who cannot be manipulated, the one who need not be assisted, and the one who must be trusted. But in this passage, Jacob himself uses a specific name for God that is distinctively found here. And whereas the last passage called us to trust the God of Bethel, this passage calls us to trust the fear of Isaac. Look there in verse 42. If the God of my father, the God of Abraham, and the fear of Isaac had not been on my side, surely you would have sent me away empty-handed. And look at verse 53. So Jacob swore by the fear of his father Isaac. So he's taken an oath. This swearing of oaths, you swear a promise and you do it consciously before the face of God. And Jacob describes him as the fear of Isaac. Now, what do we think of when we think about God as one to be feared? Well, we see that for the unbeliever, that fear is lacking. Psalm 36 and verse 1 speaks about the wicked, that there is no fear of God before his eyes. That's the nature of unbelievers, that they're not worried about what they do because they're not worried about what God will think about them. They're characterized by ignoring. But the fear of God can be felt even by unbelievers. If we were to read Exodus chapter 15 and verse 16, which is Moses singing the song of the Lord after going through the Red Sea and thinking about God defeating his enemies in Egypt, the Egyptians, and defeating the enemies in the Promised Land, it says this: terror and dread fall upon them because of the greatness of your arm. They are still as a stone. Think about a king like Ahab. He was a wicked man, wasn't he? But he feared God in the sense of he humbled himself before the power of God. So the unbeliever, naturally, there's no fear of God before his eyes. But when he sees God work in power, even the unbeliever can learn to fear him. And we know that the unbeliever will fear God sooner or later. As it says in Isaiah chapter 2, and verse 10. Enter into the rock and hide in the dust from before the terror of the Lord and from the splendor of his majesty. That's picked up on in Revelation, isn't it? May the hills fall on us, the mountains cover us before his anger. So we know that there's different ways in which the unbeliever learns to fear God, even without being saved. But the fear of God is very important to the believer. So, for example, 2 Chronicles and chapter 19 and verse 7. 2 Chronicles 19, verse 7. When Jehoshaphat was seeking to put the country right, he said, "Let the fear of the Lord be upon you. Be careful what you do, for there is no injustice with the Lord our God, or partiality, or taking bribes." So the believer, Jehoshaphat was calling the believers to, when they were administering the country, to think, "I need to do it justly, before the face of God." And we know in our land, wouldn't we love judges whose worry is, what would God think about this judgment? And indeed, the believer, when the believer is thinking about God's law, Psalm 119, and verse 120. The psalmist says, "My flesh trembles for fear of you, for I'm afraid of your judgments." That is the fear of the believer, worried, trembling before the Lord. "On this one will I look," says Isaiah, "who's of a poor and contrite spirit, and who trembles at my words. So when we see God described as the fear of Isaac, it shouldn't surprise us in the light of all these things. It's an important way of describing him. Now, as we see Jacob describing him in this way, we also see Laban as operating with just that level of unbelieving fear. Just his power. He's at this kind of Ahab level of power, but not this Jacob level of trust. And as we go through the passage, considering the fear of Isaac, we'll see two things contrasted within the passage. Firstly, the powerless idols of Laban, and then the powerful protection of the fear of Isaac. So the powerless idols of Laban, and then the powerful protection of the fear of Isaac. We'll see how these things come together. So let's start off by looking at Laban, and a massive centre of this passage is idolatry, being ridiculed. And we'll also see other idols that Laban has along the way. So first idol that Laban is having exposed, his idol of his own schemes. Laban trusts himself, doesn't he? I mean, I'm glad I wasn't buying a used car off Laban. I mean, what would that used car be like? How long would it go? He would be having it, wouldn't he? And the HMRC might be not too happy with Laban either. He was a wheeler and a dealer, and he always thinks, I'll just kind of wheedle my way out of this one. Now, his schemes are not looking so good. So in verse 20, Jacob, he's a shepherd, and he knows with an unerring accuracy, what is the busiest time of year? Sheep shearing. So Jacob thinks, right, Laban is a 3-day journey away and he's sheep shearing. So that's when I'm running. And Laban is mad. And the words that are being used for Laban have got a military sense. So look at what it says in verse 23. Laban pursued. That's like an army going in for the kill. And in verse 25, then he overtook and pitched his tent. He's getting ready for the battle. How do we know he's absolutely furious? Well, where does he get to? We know he's told on the third day that Jacob had fled. He may have had to kind of get supplies ready. And then he pursues in verse 23 for 7 days into the hill country of Gilead. Now, we just read that hill country of Gilead. That's at least 300 miles away. I mean, imagine you with Laban and some people with Laban. You're like, Laban, how many days are we going to do this for? We've left the sheep shearing behind. And how many days are we going to go away from home? I mean, Jacob's home's way to the south, but how many more days, Laban? Are we still going? What's his plan? He's pursuing. Is he going to kill Jacob? What's he up to? But we find that Laban, who trusts in himself and his schemes, can't cope with God's intervention. Now, previously, God has intervened in Jacob's life by circumstances. Now, do you remember that time when Abraham's servant came and he wanted to take Rebecca to be married to Isaac? Now, Laban noted that this was an amazing occurrence. And in Genesis 24, verse 50, when he's asked whether Rebecca can go or not, he says this: "The thing has come from the Lord. We cannot speak to you, bad or good." The thing has come from the Lord. We cannot speak to you, bad or good. He sees God's power and working, and he says, we cannot speak to you, bad or good. And therefore, isn't it striking that now God comes more directly than circumstances? He comes in a dream, verse 24 of chapter 31. "Be careful not to say anything to Jacob, either good or bad." It's that phrase again. Now, you might say, either good or bad? What, you're just not talking to him? Well, what does this phrase mean? Well, it's one of those phrases where if we think about something as high or low, we might use that phrase, as high or low. Now, we don't just mean things that are at the very highest and things at the very lowest. That phrase would mean and everything in between. So when he says don't speak to anything, Jacob, good or bad, God's saying, whatever word you use to Jacob, know this. I'm in control of the whole speech. Don't say anything in any way that I wouldn't be happy with. So God is binding him and saying, Laban, you are a man under my control. So when in verse 29, Laban says, it's my power to do you harm. No, it's not, Laban. It's not. That's an empty boast. Laban is talking big. He's talking big because he can't act. Because God has stepped in. The idol of his schemes, he can scheme all he likes, but God steps in. And if this morning that you're tempted to live by your wits, to wheel and deal and put your trust in your ability, I'm going in a situation, how can I kind of get my way out of here? This gives us a warning, because we're called in every situation not to think how I can wheel or deal out of this, to think, what does God tell me to do, and how can I apply the principles of his word in this situation? So the powerless idols of Laban, his schemes. But this passage particularly picks up on the powerless idols of his household gods. The only thing that Laban thinks when he meets Jacob that he's got on him is, you're a thief. He thinks, well, at least I've got this on him. Verse 30, you've gone away. Why did you steal my gods? Now notice what happens next. And we see a meeting between Laban and Rachel. And Laban goes and he's searching around for these gods. And he comes into Rachel's tent. Now, I can back up for a minute. How do you think Rachel thinks of her dad? She loved Jacob. She wanted to marry him. And then her dad had stopped her marrying him and given her sister in marriage. She's not going to forget that from her dad in a hurry, is she? He's not going to be generally favourable to her dad. And what was her dad's excuse? Well, his excuse was, custom says the oldest marries first. And therefore, there's certainly at least an irony here when Rachel says, custom says the manner of woman is upon me, I can't rise. Sorry about that, custom says so. But notice, this passage is really mocking idols. Now again, like with polygamy, it doesn't pause for us to think and explain it. But God gave us stories, and the stories make a point. For example, what kind of gods can get stolen and need to be chased for and hunted out? Already Laban, his household gods don't seem to be worth very much if they can't stop themselves being stolen and he's got to hunt them out. But there's more to it here. There's more to it. You might think the gods should be shouting out, here I am. But they can't do that either. But it's the utter disrespect. So any Israelite would be thinking of God's stipulation in the law. Leviticus 15:20 says that everything on which a woman lies during her menstrual impurity shall be unclean. Everything also on which she sits shall be unclean. And therefore the Jew reading this will be just thinking, well, the God is supposed to be the cleanest and it's now the uncleanest. This is just absolute disrespect to this God. So the Jew reading this would just be saying, these gods are now looking ridiculous. And Laban's gods are being seen as powerless. They couldn't stop Jacob fleeing. He had to run after them. He couldn't get them. And now they are ritually unclean. They're just looking ridiculous. But there's one other idol that's gone to dust for Laban. And it's an idol that Paul tells us is idolatry. Covetousness, Paul says, Colossians 3:5, is idolatry. And Laban had been a man on the make. Now, notice how he's been speaking, as you read the passage, about the things that Jacob has. Verse 43 says, "The children of my children, the flocks of my flocks, all that you see is mine." Well, that's what Laban thinks. Problem is, it isn't. And when we see Jacob in this passage, you kind of see 20 years of frustration coming out. I mean, Jacob is really unloading on Laban, isn't he? He is absolutely letting him have it. Verse 38. "These 20 years I've been with you," and he goes through a whole series of things. "Your ewes and your female goats have not miscarried. I've not eaten the rams of your flocks. What was torn by wild beasts I did not bring to you. I bore the loss of it myself. From my hand you required it, whether stolen by day or stolen by night." And if you think about the idyllic shepherd pictures, well, Jacob wasn't thinking in idyllic shepherd pictures. "There I was. By day the heat consumed me, and the cold by night, and my sleep fled from my eyes. These 20 years I've been in your house. I served you 14 years for your two daughters, 6 years for your flock, and you've changed my wages 10 times. Jacob's been mistreated and mistreated and mistreated. And Laban's thought, I'll get that, I'll get that, I'll get that. And it's all gone to dust. He says, these things are mine. Well, they're not, because they're Jacob's and they're gone. Jacob's gone. His daughters have gone. His grandchildren have gone. His flocks have gone in the main. It's all gone. And so we see here the absolute tragedy of Laban. He has lived by his wits. He's interested in these gods. They've done him no good. He's interested in his trickery. That's done him no good. He's got his covetous heart. That's done him no good. And he's left as a tragic figure, as we'll consider more as we look at this passage. He sees so much of God's power and is left with nothing. The absolute tragedy of Laban, the powerless idols of Laban. It encourages us, don't trust anything else than the true God. You this morning, what are you hoping will get you through life? You might say, hey, I'm doing quite well at school. I'm doing all right. I'll be all right. I'll get a job. Or you might say, well, I'm not doing so well at school, but hey, I'll be all right. I can make friends. I can good at making friends. I'll do that. Or, well, I'm not quite sure how things are going, but something will turn up. This passage is calling us, let's trust God. He's the only one who can help us. And so let's see, after we've seen the powerless idols of Laban, the powerful protection of the fear of Isaac. There's a very strange thing that happens in verse 44. Laban says, "Come, let us make a covenant." Now, why does Laban want a covenant? Well, when do you want someone to promise you something? Well, you usually want someone to promise you something when you've got some doubt about them. Now, Jacob doesn't need a covenant with Laban, does he? He's not asked for any covenant with Laban. He doesn't need a covenant with Laban. He's got God's protection. God's in covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God's made promises to bless Jacob. He's fine. He doesn't need a covenant with Laban. He can make one, but he doesn't need one. Why does Laban need one? It's bizarre, isn't it? Because does Jacob have any intention of bothering Laban again? No. He's been running away from him. He's going back to the promised land. So what's going on? Well, it just seems Laban is trying to save face. I mean, you've got all these people who have come with you. So what's happened, Laban? Well, we've pursued for days and days and days after leaving the sheep shearing behind. And what have you done? Well, I had a dream from God, told not to touch Jacob. So we've all got to go back empty handed and hope things will go well in the future. I mean, if you're a Laban's herdsman, it's not doing your respect for Laban very much favours, is it? So Laban's got to get something out of this. So he says, okay, he's now begging for a covenant. He's trying to save a bit of face. At least we've got something out of this. Now notice as he asks for this covenant, he says, a witness between you and me. And he says in verse 49, the Lord watch between you and me. Verse 50, if you oppress my daughters, you might say, Laban, who's been oppressing Leah? It certainly wasn't Jacob, in that sense of being utterly deceitful towards her. Or if you take wives beside my daughters, well, there's no indication he's going to take any more wives. God is witness between you and me. But what does Laban have to do? Well, in verse 53, Laban says this, the God of Abraham and the God of Nahor, the God of their father, judge between us. Laban has got to acknowledge the power is not the power of his gods, hasn't he? But Laban is still a polytheist, believing in multiple gods. So the verb in verse 53 is plural. So when we read it in English, we think, well, the God of Abraham is the God of Nahor and the God of their father. Okay, we just think, well, that's the same person, which it is. But that's not how Laban says it. He's talking about three gods, like the ancestral gods, plural. He acknowledges their power. But Jacob doesn't speak in that way. He swore by the fear of his father Isaac. Now, that's a very strong word for fear. We could describe it as God the Intimidator. God the Intimidator. Now, you know at the moment that the Americans have sent some aircraft carriers to the Middle East. And they're sitting there. And it's not just they've decided that they're doing their round-the-world cruise and they're just seeing if there's any nice visits to make in the Middle East. They're sitting there to try and intimidate Iran. That's their purpose. Sitting there to create fear so that they don't have to do anything. That's the idea. And Jacob is speaking about God as having such power that he's the one who stops people doing things that's wrong. Simply people by understanding him in the right way. And Jacob's saying, Laban, that's what you should worry about. Not just God's power, but truly who he is. And God protects Jacob further. Because God, through this unnecessary covenant, from Jacob's perspective, gives a clear break from his past. Verse 52, the pillar is witness. I will not pass over this heap to you, and you will not pass over this heap and this pillar to me to do harm. And at this point, a decisive break comes. Remember where Abraham's come from? Abraham's come from the east. He's come from the far east, from Ur. He's come around the Fertile Crescent towards the north, stopped in Haran, and then some of his people have stopped there, like Laban, and then he's come down to the Promised Lands. And so, up to this point, they've gone up there to find wives, haven't they? But now, no more. So you're saying, no more connection with Ur, that's gone already. Now no more connection with Haran, the Syrian. Sometimes you see in Bible version, Laban the Syrian. There's a boundary set. And so God is fencing his people into the promised land. That the past is broken. God is protecting. So let's see where we leave these two people as they part together. So they offer a sacrifice, verse 54. Notice it doesn't say they offer a sacrifice. Who offered the sacrifice, verse 54? Jacob offered the sacrifice. He's the believer. Laban's an unbeliever. Early in the morning, Laban arose, kissed his grandchildren and his daughters, and blessed them. Laban departed and returned home. Think about Laban for a minute. His sister is in the messianic line. That's Rebekah. His daughter, Leah, is in the messianic line. Leah bore Judah. Laban experienced God's blessing through Jacob. He saw that God was blessing him. He admitted it. He saw it. And God spoke personally to Laban in a dream. Now you might be saying this morning, look, if only God, I'd see evidence of God, I would believe in him. What does Laban say? Not necessarily. God has spoken directly to Laban, but he still doesn't trust him. He recognizes his power, but he doesn't trust him. Why? Because his covetousness, his schemes, his household gods came before the true God. So let me speak to you this morning and say, is anybody here who you know that God speaks? You've heard him speaking through his words. You've seen his power in those people who you know and love, your family. You've seen his power. You've seen his blessing. How tragic for you if you were to be like a Laban. And on the last day, you would know those who knew God, but you didn't know him yourself. That's an absolute tragedy. Don't, this pastor would say, don't let that be you. Fear God and come to him and make him your God. And then he'll be like Jacob in the sense that God says, I will be with you. And he'll be with us. Don't be a Laban. There's a tragedy of the Laban set before us this morning. But more positively, we have the security of Jacob. That's what you're called to come to. The security of Jacob. Now in Isaiah chapter 8, it speaks about the fear of God. Do not call, Isaiah says, speaking the words of God, conspiracy, all that this people calls conspiracy, and do not fear what they fear, nor be in dread. But the Lord of hosts, him you shall honour as holy, let him be your fear, and let him be your dread. We're in a world of lots of fears. People worry about lots of things. And the Bible calls us to fear God. Fear him, you saints, and then you will have nothing else to fear. It will be put everything in perspective. We're told to trust the fear of Isaac. That's the characteristic of the believer, that they fear God and suddenly find everything else comes into perspective. They wouldn't want to do anything to upset him. Now, I was reading this week of a Berliner called Maria Linke. And she was a resident of Berlin when the Russians came in at the end of the Second World War. Now, Maria, due to her upbringing, spoke fluent Russian. So the Russians thought, great, we need someone to spew out communist propaganda. You're ideal, they said, Maria. But Maria was a Christian. And she said, no, I'm not going to spew out atheist propaganda. I'm a believer in God. So the communists imprisoned her, beat her up, and encouraged her to become a propagandist. I think she was imprisoned for a total of 9 years. And at one point, they even threatened her with death. And she was asked, do you still believe in God? She was literally staring down the barrel of a gun. And her response was, well, if God allows me to be killed, he allows me to be killed, but only if he allows it. And she said, well, I'm ready to die and face the consequences. If God allows it, he allows it. If he doesn't allow it, he doesn't allow it. Now, the communists didn't take kindly to that and pulled the trigger. And nothing happened. Tried to check it out, try again. Nothing happened. Threw the gun down and told her to get out. But she was in a moment a bit like Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego. She was not expecting a miracle. She was expecting heaven. But she knew God's protection. So I've come across that not from some kind of sensationalist literature, but from some more well-known publisher. What's the point? The point is, she feared God more than she feared man. And that is the characteristic of a believer. We don't know as believers where we're going to be. We don't know what we're going to have to face. God tells us not to worry about this life, not to worry about tomorrow. We're to worry about one thing: Him. Pleasing Him. The fear of Isaac. That's how God's being described to us. The fear of Isaac. That we would do anything rather than upset Him. And that we would be happiest if we're under His smile, knowing His blessing, knowing Him with us, knowing Him as our fear. And the one whom we fear is the one who loves, protects, stays with, and takes us home to be with Him when, like Jacob, we've been pilgrims through this world. Amen.